into our discussion / teaching time. Be sure to be commenting in the comment section. We've got 3 or 4 areas that we're going to be asking for some feedback on, and we would love to hear from you about your experiences, both the fun experiences and, as we get into this, a little of the serious, deep experiences together. So we're going to be kind of embracing a discussion that few people enjoy having. But before we do, my anniversary is in November. And for Jennifer and my 10th anniversary, we traveled to Las Vegas. Even though we aren't drinkers or gamblers or partiers, we still decided that there was enough in Vegas to do, which there absolutely was. I didn't get to do everything I wanted to do. But we went to 2 specific events that I don't know if you could get further from the type. We went to a Tony Bennett concert. Now, if you don't know Tony Bennett, he is he was part of the old school crooner singers. His contemporary were like Frank Sinatra. I truly believe Tony Bennett will live forever and will outlive all of us. And even he was in his mid 90s when we saw him. He still brought the house down. But the second one that we went to see were the magicians Penn and Teller. And they, like I said, it is pretty much the polar opposites. But one of the things I love magic. And the central principle that Penn and Teller, in their interviews and in some of the shows they've done, their central principle of magic is that the people want to be fooled. People don't want to know the truth. And when you watch, especially live, and you look around at the crowd, the magic tricks are extravagant. I mean, they are just, there's a reason that they sell out 8 shows a week. And they've been doing this for 20 years. People are enamored by it. People even go up to inspect the trick. But people, for the most part, they embrace the illusion. They don't want to know how the trick is done. Knowing how the trick is done ruins the illusion. But for most of us, the world doesn't operate like a magic show. We don't want to be fooled. We want to know, first and foremost, we want to know if something is true. But we want to know if something is good. And people in the world around us, more and more, they're skeptical of life. They're skeptical of people. They're skeptical of religion. And often they look on matters of faith with suspicion. And religious people too often respond in kind, and we develop this adversarial relationship. The doubter is treated as an outcast, and people of faith, at least in our circles, are hailed as heroes. In other circles, it's literally the opposite. But I want to encourage us to take a different look at the idea of doubt and skepticism, because even though it's not easy and it's not simple, doubt doesn't have to be a 4-letter word. And we're going to discover that doubt is not the end or the enemy of faith, but is often the beginning of true, lasting, life-transforming faith. But before we get too far into that, I want to hear about your own experiences with belief. We're not going to go too serious, I don't think, though. Let's talk about, maybe we will. I don't know. Maybe you believe something insane as a kid.
You looked at me a couple times on that one.
Well, I mean, you're a wild card, Nicholas. But I want to hear one of 2 things. I want to either hear about something you believed as a kid that you don't believe now, and maybe a second about why that changed, or conversely, something you didn't believe as a kid, but now you believe. But we're not going to go too deep. We're going to have plenty of time to talk about Jesus in a moment. We're going to spend the whole time, basically, after this, talking about Jesus. But let's just talk, have a couple of people share either something you believed as a child that you no longer do, or vice versa.
So when I was a little kid, I stayed with my grandfather during the day because both my parents worked, and he had little ants coming out of his sidewalk, and they're red.
Oh boy.
And I don't think there were fire ants or anything like that, but I'd be like, oh, those are different. Like they're different. And he was like, those are piss ants. Cause they're always pissed off.
Oh boy.
and I believed that until I was like 6 or 7, like I was like 2 or 3 at the time when he told me that, but like, I'd be like, dad, don't step on the piss ants.
I mean, fairness, are red ants, like red ants, I would believe that they're going to bite you anyway. But
they weren't
fire ants.
We're in Connecticut. So they're little tiny, like little tiny things. I don't know what they would do or could do. But yeah, it was hilarious.
Yep. Yep.
And that'll obviously do it. I don't believe that anymore.
Obviously. All right, somebody else. What is something either that you believed as a kid or no longer believe now, or vice versa?
Well, I think going off from Franklin's story about his grandfather, I think sometimes our family can be, you know, the greatest deceivers. So for me, I remember back when we went on a family trip, my mom's whole side of the family, to Niagara Falls, and my great aunt Judy is always known to kind of joke around with us. But as kids, we took her seriously. And while we were in Niagara Falls, she had us dead convinced that we could not flush the toilets at night because they shut the falls off. So I don't know when we learned that it wasn't true, because I'm pretty sure that whole trip, we just did not get up in the middle of the night and go to the bathroom. But now that I'm older, I realize I don't think they can shut off the falls. So I think we're okay.
I mean, you've been to the falls since you've been an adult.
Yeah,
so you've been able
there
to.
At night. So I still don't know.
There you go.
I guess you're either going to have to trust it or learn the hard way. Somebody else. So something you believed as a kid that you no longer believe now, or vice versa.
When I was a kid, I think I truly believed that money grew on trees.
Oh.
Like a lot of kids do, some adults.
Sure.
and then my parents just had access to this magical money tree, and that I could have whatever I wanted, and they could have whatever they wanted, and they could just pick off the money tree. And that was an awfully rude awakening. When
Wait, you mean I have to work for this?
Now I have to work, and you know, I used to get a dollar, and I thought I was rich. Like,
oh yeah.
Now,
y'all, do you remember when like getting a $20 bill was like, yeah. Yo, I'm in the money now. Right.
I'm set for life.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Absolutely. Anybody else?
I have back to grandfathers and uncles.
Yeah.
We spent many summers as young kids in West Virginia, and I don't know if anybody is familiar with snipe hunting.
But, I'm not. yep.
I can't tell you how many nights my uncle had us kids out there with a burlap bag with a flashlight in it, out in the middle of a dark field, being really quiet because we wanted to catch a snipe. And this went on for days, and actually a couple summers before we finally realized there's no such thing as a snipe. This was the way they kept the kids
entertained.
Yeah, so it's kind of like a rite of passage now for each of the young kids as they come along to go
snipe
hunting.
Nice. It's like, you remember cow tipping at discipleship camp? We have a shared experience where they'd go cow tipping when they were seniors in the program. And that was always just code for, we're going to stay up late and eat junk food and watch rubbish. that was all that it meant. So basically what you're saying is that was the makings of Bigfoot hunters. It's the same thing, right?
Yeah.
I think the thing for me that I believed wholeheartedly, to the point that I think the first time, like, let me rewind. I'm going ahead of myself. I believed the myth that if you swallowed chewing gum, it would sit in your gut for 7 years. I don't know if you guys heard that, but I was so terrified of swallowing gum. And you know how kids, I think it was like 8 or 9, like kids go all in when they mess up. Like I had a big wad of bubble gum in my mouth, and I swallowed, like that thing was massive. And it broke my little heart that I thought I was going to die, because there's no way that big old clump of bubble gum was not going to kill me. Like that was it. The end, game over. I believed that with all of my heart. I went crying to my mom, and she had to break it to me. It might've been my mother that told me, but I feel like it was a teacher, which teachers, don't do that to your kids. That terrifies them. Like, lie to your children, but don't terrify your children. Come on. It's not working. I think my mother was like, hey, it's fine. It'll pass. It's okay. And that was the day I've learned. My mother has revealed beautiful truths to me and truths that have broken my little heart. So that was one of the times that was a real positive thing. And I've learned over the years, as I've grown, I have learned a lot about truth and non-truth, belief and disbelief in my life. I've learned some of these beautiful things that you can swallow gum without any fear of it destroying you. I mean, don't swallow your gum, but it's probably okay. I've learned hard truths, like fool's gold is actual fake gold. I had to learn that the hard way. You talk about family. That was my uncle. My uncle loved messing with us, and he convinced me that fool's gold was valuable. It's not. And as I've grown, I developed this skepticism in my life, this questioning nature. And when we think about that term doubt, one of Jesus' main followers has become synonymous with doubt. In fact, we often, when we talk about him, we often relegate him to the status of shame because he was known as a doubter. But today I want to look at the story of the life of a man named Thomas and learn that Thomas's story is not and should not be a story of shame, but a story of victory. So we're going to be looking at a couple of Bible verses today. The first is going to be in Luke chapter 24. And we're going to learn about the resurrection of Jesus and the impact that it has had on the life of Thomas. If you don't remember the story of Jesus' resurrection, the last days of Jesus' life were intense and difficult. He was betrayed by one of his closest followers. He was put through not just one, but two rigged trials. He was unjustly tortured and executed. And in Luke 24, we see in verse 12 that the disciples of Jesus knew that the tomb was empty. And they were told by the women who had encountered the angels that he was risen. But in verse 12, it says that Peter jumped up and ran to the tomb to look. Stooping, he peered in and he saw the empty linens wrappings, and then he went home wondering what had happened. So already there's still this sense of confusion that is happening, even though they had been told by the women who had seen angels, which people don't tend to see angels all that often, even in the Bible. But they're told this, but they're still unsure of what happened. And Luke goes on to tell us that Jesus' first interaction with anybody else wasn't even his closest followers. He appears to two random people that are called disciples, but we don't know their names. We don't know their relationship to Jesus beyond that. And so they come back and tell Jesus' core 11 followers about this encounter. And in verse 35, they're relaying this to them. And then in 36, something incredible happens. And just as they were telling about it, Jesus himself was suddenly standing there among them. "Peace be with you," Jesus said. But the whole group was startled and terrified, thinking that they had seen a ghost. I want to pause real quick and just remind us of a couple of things. Even in Jesus' day, dead people didn't come back to life. It's a common thing I've had people say. It's like, well, they were superstitious. And I said, well, that may or may not be true. But dead people didn't just come back to life. That's not how it worked. So even then, the story of Jesus was not an easy thing to believe. The story of a resurrected person was a strange thing to happen. And so believing that they had seen a ghost sounds crazy, but it made more sense than the story that they were being demanded to believe. So they believed that they had seen a ghost, but Jesus knew what was going on in their hearts. So he asks, why are you frightened? Why are your hearts filled with doubt? Look at my hands. Look at my feet. You can see that it's really me. Touch me and make sure that I'm not a ghost, because ghosts don't have bodies, as you see that I do. And Jesus is freeing them from the shackles of fear and the shackles of defeat that had hung over them since Jesus' execution. But in John 20, we learn something new about the story. We learn that not all of the 11 remaining disciples were there. In John chapter 20, verse 24, we read that Thomas, one of the disciples, nicknamed the twin, was not with the others when Jesus came. And they told him, "We have seen the Lord." But he replied, "I won't believe it unless I see the nail wounds in his hands, put my fingers in them, and place my hand into the wounds on his side. I will not believe." And what's interesting here is this is what Thomas is known for. This is Thomas's big test, at least as we treat it. And we act as though Thomas is hard-hearted or hard-headed. We treat him like somebody that should be chided or shamed because he did not trust what he was told. But I think it's important to remember the story of Thomas and what was going on in his heart. Remember, first of all, that Thomas had left everything to follow Jesus, his family, his job, his life, his future. And Thomas had also either witnessed Jesus' death or knew exactly how it ended. And again, Thomas knew what we all know is that dead people don't come back to life. And at worst, Thomas knew that if the story was true, it would be earth-shattering and world-altering. If Jesus was alive, if Jesus had risen, it changes everything. If Jesus is alive, it changes the course of history. And for him, he struggled to come to terms with it. But it's not because he didn't want it to be true. But what we know is that Thomas was unwilling to settle for secondhand faith. He needed to have a firsthand encounter with the risen Christ so it could be made real for him. And I don't know if it's something that you've ever experienced, this idea of secondhand faith. I know for me in my life, I grew up in a church. And so if you've never grown up in the church, this may be new to you, but maybe not. Maybe you had a friend or a coworker or a classmate that you kind of inherited their faith, but it was never really your own. And so I want to ask the people around the circle and you at home, have you ever experienced secondhand faith? Faith that you inherited but never made your own. How is it different than your faith now? How did it falter, or did it falter, and what brought you back? So I'll open that up for anybody that's in the circle. What is your experience with secondhand faith?
I guess when I think of secondhand faith, as I was growing up before I had a real relationship with God, is I remember being with people who had a real fire for God, a real belief in him. And I just remember being with them and you could just feel it, you know, feel like, you know, you have God in you. And then when you leave their presence and you're going through the week, you know, they talk about like Sunday Christians and then it's like everything just kind of falls away. It's like you want to be back with those people. And then I had my relationship with God began to grow. And I can feel how they felt now, and it's so different, you know, and it doesn't leave me when I leave church on Sunday. Mm. It goes with me. And I guess that's the way I see secondhand faith.
Absolutely. Anybody else?
I think for me, like, I think of the difference kind of like between sixth and seventh grade, like when I first started going to youth group. Like, I always grew up in the church. I'm forever grateful for my mom for bringing us every Sunday, for my grandparents for, you know, raising us to have faith. But I don't know if it was just that it clicked, or I was finally kind of at youth group doing my own thing. Mm-hmm. But that's when I really recognized that my faith kind of became my own, and I started to dive deeper into things.
Sure. Absolutely. Anybody else have any thoughts on that? What's your experience been? I know for me, my secondhand faith experience has been kind of it's a story that many have told who have gone through Christian circles. I was talking to my mother about it this week, about our fundamentalist, legalistic, judgmental background. My mom was in many ways the spiritual head of our household growing up, like me in some ways, she goes all in. You cannot accuse my mother of not being 100% sold on whatever it is she believes. And at the time, we had a very, very specific way of believing. And that's okay. I have a very, very specific way of believing. The challenge that the way I was raised at the time was that you had to believe these things in order to be a Christian. And it wasn't important things. It was things like, I was homeschooled. And if you weren't homeschooled, you weren't a good Christian. If you didn't believe in a certain interpretation of the Bible, then you weren't a real Christian. If you read the Harry Potter books, you weren't a real Christian. And the inherited faith that I received was that judgmental, fundamentalistic, culture warrior, adversarial, not even with the world, but with other Christians, telling them how they're wrong. And I think for me, where it kind of all came to a head was realizing that I didn't believe all that. And I couldn't piece together Jesus from this list of beliefs that I had to believe in order to be a Christian. And for me, Sarah, you shared that it kind of all fell into place. For me, it all kind of fell apart. And for 3 or 4 years, I was a mess. I kind of devolved into a bundle of anger and frustration and hatred, because I felt like, in some ways, I felt like I was living a lie. In some ways, I felt like I wanted to believe, but I couldn't believe. And I'll share here in a few minutes a little bit of kind of what turned that around. But I know for me, that was my experience with secondhand faith, because when I came to the point where I couldn't believe at all, I believed that if I couldn't believe at all, then none of it must be real. And I think that's a story that I've had a lot of people share. In fact, the response that I have now is that I wish that somebody had known my struggle, because I've said this to so many people. The God I did not believe in as a teenager is the same God I don't believe in now. And I believe that with all my heart. I had a picture of God that was not the picture that Jesus paints. And I'm so glad that I no longer believe in that picture of God. And maybe you're watching you resonate with that idea of doubt, maybe even you have, maybe you consider yourself an ex-Christian or a former Christian because your experience is similar to mine. Many people, regardless of where they start, they come to a point where they have to face the claims of Christianity head on, and we really can't ignore them. Now, some of us, we'd prefer to pretend like they don't exist, but the claims of Christianity is quite extraordinary. The the claim that Jesus is God, always existing and all powerful, that he was born of a virgin, that he lived life without sin, that he won victory over the powers of darkness in his death, that he paid the ransom for our sin by taking our place, and that he didn't stay dead. And not unlike Thomas, we often have to realize that if the claims of Christianity are true, it demands a response. And to me, the only reasonable response for a Savior who died for me is to live for him. And I wonder if Thomas's response wasn't because he was hard-hearted, was because he recognized that if it's true, it changes everything. And so when you think of your relationship between faith and doubt, you may be tempted to say, I can't have faith because I doubt. But what I've learned and what I've come face to face with is that often real faith is something that you receive when you press through sincere doubt. In fact, sometimes for some of us, or for people like me at very least, you can't have real faith unless or until you've pressed through or pressed into those sincere doubts. And what I've learned is that doubt doesn't have to be the end of real faith. For many people, and for me, the beginning of my faith came out of my doubts and brought me to a rock solid faith that carries me on to glorify God, or at least seek to glorify God in everything that I do. I needed more. Thomas needed more. And on that day, the risen Jesus met Thomas exactly where Thomas needed him to. In verse 26, we learn that 8 days later, the disciples were together again. And this time, Thomas was with them. Listen, I don't know where Thomas was, but let me tell you, I would never miss another meeting as long as I lived at that point. This tells you how important it is to meet together. And so 8 days later, they're there and Thomas is with them and the doors were locked. But suddenly, as before, Jesus was standing among them. And again, he said, "Peace be with you." And then he went to Thomas and he says, "Put your fingers here. Look at my hands. Put your fingers into the wound in my side. Don't be faithless any longer, but believe." The New International Version puts it a little more succinctly, says, "Stop doubting and believe." Jesus shows up again through a locked door. And he goes right to Thomas. And I don't know about you. This is one of those things that remind me how amazing Jesus is, because my reaction, I feel like, would be markedly different than Jesus. I feel like I might chastise him, yell at him, remind him of all of the times I said, "Listen, I have to go to Jerusalem. I'm going to die. And then on the third day, I'm going to rise again." Like, Jesus said that countless times at this point. Why aren't you listening, Thomas? He might have ostracized him or even demoted him. Like, "Listen, you're not one of my disciples anymore, you fool. Go away. I'll replace you with somebody better with more faith." But that wasn't Jesus. That's not how Jesus operates. Instead, Jesus meets Thomas right where he's at, and he gives Thomas exactly what Thomas needed. Thomas said, "I need to put my hands in his wounds. It's the only way I'll believe. That's it. No other way." And Jesus shows up and says, "Here, I'm right here, Thomas. Nothing's stopping you. Do what you got to do to turn that doubt into faith." And that is where Jesus met Thomas at the point he needed it the most. So I want to ask the people in this circle to maybe share briefly, how has Jesus met you at your point of greatest doubt and given you what you need to transform your doubt into faith?
Well, I think for me, I know I shared last week a little bit about the whole transitional season for Franklin and I. And I remember it was actually probably a couple weeks before he was heading to a college, and I was serving at Chambers Camp, which we mentioned earlier, serving as a counselor there at one of our retreats. And I was really wrestling during that time, but just of transition, because we were entering into a new season. Mm-hmm. Franklin was going to be going to college. I was going to be going back to college, and it was just going to be a new dynamic for our relationship at that time. And I was really doubting still God's path that he'd set before us, even though he'd confirmed it multiple times, providing for us financially, providing a job for Franklin there at college. But I still was just doubting. And so I remember there was one day in the middle of the week, I think it might have even been Tuesday. And so I kind of just got real with God. And I was just like, I need you to confirm this for me. And I said, and I need you to confirm this through what was my one word for the year, which was constant. So I said, I need to today hear the word constant. So, you know, we went throughout the day, went to seminars and different things, and I had not heard this word. So again, like, now I'm doubting, like, all right, is this what I'm supposed to be doing? Like, why are we going through with this? And then we were actually at the campfire that night, which campfires at D-Camp were always the best moments. And we were probably about an hour into it. And somebody was sharing a testimony. And at the end of their testimony, they shared that God is constant. And for me at that moment, like, I just immediately started crying, because it was like, okay, God, like, there's my, you know, my answer, what I've been praying for all day. And then I found out afterwards too, I texted one of my really close friends and prayer partner and sister in Christ and told her the story. And she said, you know, it's crazy. I was actually praying that God would remind you that he was constant. And that wasn't from me, that was from God. So it was just, you know, that moment where God, you know, really confirmed that, okay, this is where I want you. Like, this is the path I'm set before you, and I'll be constant through it all.
It's amazing. Anybody else?
God gave me the ability to use my music to further my faith. And that was at a point when I was doubting myself. I was doubting everything around me. I kind of touched on that last week.
And then
just by a chance encounter with you one day, that you might need a spare drummer from time to time, got me. I was able to use something that I love doing to also further my faith with God. And it was just, and it was at that point where I didn't think there were any other options. I was doubting myself, and I was just, it was such a change in my life that I wasn't even expecting, you know?
So. Absolutely. Absolutely. Anybody else? I know for me, I shared a little earlier of my own wrestling with my now not at all secondhand faith, my very much firsthand doubt, which led to very much firsthand anger and frustration and even hatred. And that was primarily manifested through anger and hatred toward my parents. And one of the things that kind of, I don't know if you've ever dealt with this kind of thing before, but I was somehow able to convince myself that the position I'd put myself in made me unworthy of love. I certainly didn't love myself. I in many ways was out of control. And I hated that, but also, again, this is if you've never been there, this will make sense. I hated it, but I also loved it. I loved the rush of being out of control. But in my heart of hearts, my inability to love myself convinced me that God was unable to love me. And over a 2 or 3 year span, my anger got more and more violent. I'd never hurt anybody before, and thank God I've never knowingly, as far as I'm aware, ever hurt somebody. But even my anger never turned to threats until that one night that I don't remember the lead up, but I remember so clearly the anger, the threatening to run away at 17, which is not a good look. But somewhere in there, I began to threaten my parents with bodily harm. And then I was about this size, maybe a little bigger. I know I'm a gentle giant 99.9% of the time, but I tell you what, don't get this angry man or this French man angry, because I'll come for you. And my parents called the police, which I don't blame them. I was an out of control teenager who's hormonal and angry and violent, and I would have done the same. The police came and they were super nice. They're Canadian. What can I say? Good old Canadian boys. They weren't Mounties, but might as well. And they told me this. They were honest with me. They're like, you can't stay here tonight. Which, again, don't blame them. And I honestly assumed I was going to spend the night in jail. What I didn't know is that my parents called two people. They called the police and they called my youth pastor, who I always looked up to. He was, I shared, I think last week or the week before, about the one guy that played Jesus. My youth pastor, Andrew, was the regular Jesus in our Easter plays. This is all coming full circle. And so Andrew came over and he was there when they were kind of the cops were laying out the reality for me. They said, you can't stay here. You got to find another place to stay. And it was like 9:30 at night. Where was I going to go? And Andrew told me, without consulting his wife, which I think was very risky, he said, come and stay at my house. Actually, it was an apartment. Come and stay at my apartment. He's like, you're going to sleep on my couch and it's going to be okay. And it was a midweek. I'm sure he had other things. Listen, I've been in his shoes. I've been a youth pastor. I'm a pastor now. I'm sure he had a million things on his plate, but I think he stayed up until about 3 a.m. with me. And it's not so much, I don't remember a thing that Andrew said to me, but I remember what he didn't say. And I think in that negative space is what changed me. That night changed me. I think my hatred of myself caused my biggest doubt to be that I was worthy of being forgiven, worthy of being loved, worth redeeming. And that night I experienced Jesus through the action of a man that took a risk on an idiot kid. And that proved to me in a way that I didn't see coming that God loved me, and I didn't have to doubt that anymore. God gave me exactly what I needed at the time I needed it the most. Yeah, it may not have been a miracle like Thomas, but I tell you what, it was a miracle to me. When Thomas encountered Jesus, he made an exclamation. Notice that even when Jesus offered his hands and his side, Thomas didn't take him up on the offer. Instead, he fell to the ground and he said, my Lord and my God. It wasn't a theological statement. He wasn't reciting anything that he was taught to say, because suddenly in that moment, Thomas's doubts melted away and he cried out from his heart. He was face to face with the truth. God met him where he needed it the most, and it changed everything. And that's what happened to me that night. And I'm crazy enough to believe that it could happen for somebody watching today, that somehow something bigger than me is going to break through into your heart and is going to help you stop doubting and believe. For me, it was my youth pastor that showed love that was unmerited, that started me on a journey of discovery and led me to ministry and to where I am today. For Thomas, his story ended, at least according to tradition, very differently than you might have expected. Thomas became a prolific missionary, traveling the farthest of any of the disciples, reaching as far as India. Thomas made enemies from those who hated the transforming power of Jesus that was on display. He was executed after being given an opportunity to renounce Jesus. And his response was, "I would never renounce my Lord and my God." The story of Thomas is too often tied to a story of doubt. But it wasn't the end of his story. On the other side of doubt, Thomas found faith stronger than he ever could have imagined. And some of you may have began this morning with doubt. Some of you may have began this morning, I don't know, maybe you tuned in and you had no intentions of lasting this long. Maybe your experience has been one of pain. Maybe the idea of religion in your life has been practically a joke. But maybe this morning God is giving you something new. Something different. Something better.